The KBOO News is up with FSRN, Free Speech Radio News, followed by an interview from Progressive Radio featuring Cynthia Enloe.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing and Gazelle Full Circle Resale. Now accepting like-new natural fiber clothing, jewelry, accessories, and curios. Gazelle and Full Circle Resale are both located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont and can be reached at 503-284-4192.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, the 10th of November, 2006. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. Analysts indicate that a Democratic sweep won't necessarily translate into major changes for the war in Iraq. Texas death row inmates end their nearly month-long strike denouncing inhumane prison conditions. And it's been 11 years since Ken Saro-Wiwa was violently executed. We'll hear about Shell's new plans for Nigerian oil. All that and more, but first, these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines.
We're going to find the correct days, Free Speech Radio News, and bring that to you momentarily. Until then, we're going to hear some music.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, November 13th, 2006. From KPFA in Berkeley, I'm Aaron Glantz, sitting in for Aldo Bogado. President Bush meets with his father's Secretary of State about what to do in Iraq.
I'm not sure what the report is going to say. I'm looking forward to seeing it.
The Democrats give conflicting signals of where they stand on the war.
And we're going to urge the president on a bipartisan basis, hopefully, to change course in Iraq.
The president said, I'll be glad to work with the Democrats as long as they agree with my goal to win in Iraq. Well, now that's what he's been saying all along.
And Joseph Kabila appears headed for victory at the polls in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Those stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. Political figures, celebrities, and social leaders met on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. today to break ground for the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial. The building is near the site where Dr. King delivered his famous I Have a Dream speech in 1963. Former President Bill Clinton authorized the construction of the memorial more than 10 years ago. Project organizers say they have raised $65 million of the estimated $100 million needed for the monument's construction and maintenance. The memorial is expected to open sometime after the spring of 2008. Lebanon is facing a new round of political turmoil after a sixth member of its 24-member cabinet quit the government today. Jackson Ellers has more.
Environment Minister Yaqub Saras' resignation on Monday followed Saturday's resignation of five cabinet members of the Shia Muslim opposition, represented by Hezbollah and its ally the Amal Party. Saraf, a Christian loyal to the Syrian-backed President Emil Lahoud, joined Hezbollah's demands for better representation in government for its allies, particularly the country's most powerful Christian opposition leader, Michel Aoun. The current government, headed by Prime Minister Fouad Siniora and dominated by the anti-Syrian forces that came to power after the 2005 assassination of the former Lebanese Prime Minister, Rafik Hariri, accused Hezbollah and its allies of trying to protect senior Syrian security officials, widely blamed for Hariri's death. Analysts are predicting street clashes over this current crisis as a weakened Lebanese government continues to wrestle over the statutes of a United Nations Security Council resolution meant to establish an international tribunal to try those responsible for Hariri's death. Meanwhile, Hezbollah has vowed to exercise all democratic means at its disposal if the current leadership fails to give in to the opposition demands for greater inclusion in the government. This is Jackson Allers reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
In the aftermath of a United States veto of a UN Security Council resolution to condemn an Israeli attack in Beit Hanun, Arab League countries have decided to end the economic embargo against the Palestinian government. FSRN's Remy Almagari has more.
Arab foreign ministers decided Sunday to break the eight-month-long internationally imposed economic embargo against the Hamas-led government. Hamas refuses to renounce violence, recognizes Israel, or adhere to signed peace agreements. In a related news, Palestinian Foreign Minister Mahmoud al-Zahar of the ruling Hamas party accepted Sunday the Arab peace proposal of 2002 based on peace for land formula. The White House responded positively to al-Zahar's remarks, calling them some activity on the Hamas side. In Gaza, both Hamas and Fatah have agreed on a national unity government with a new prime minister, likely Mohammed Shubair, a Palestinian academic from Gaza, in the hope that this would lead to the end of international aid cuts. The European Union Commissioner General for Foreign Relations, Ferrero Villander, emphasized the need that any new Palestinian government should meet the international community's demands, including recognition of Israel, renouncing violence, and resuming peace talks. For IAMAMC.org, I am Rami Almighari, reporting from Gaza.
In Sri Lanka, thousands of anti-war activists marched through the streets of the capital, Colombo, today to protest the increased violence in the country. Panea Monica Vasagam reports from Sri Lanka.
White flags flew from atop buildings in Colombo as thousands of demonstrators called for an end to the renewed violence in the country. The National Anti-War Front, a coalition of 130 civil bodies and political parties, had organized the protest following the assassination of Nadraja Raviraj, a Tamil lawmaker, on Friday. Tamil National Alliance, a minority party, blamed the government for the killing, but the administration denied involvement. According to defense officials, more than 3,200 people, including combatants, have been killed in clashes between the government and the Tamil Tiger rebels this year. But human rights organizations and others put the civilian figure at more than 3,000. Many fear the heavy violence raging throughout the country is driving the island nation back to a full-scale war. But the government and the rebels insist that the Norwegian brokered 2002 truce is in place. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ponnaiya Manikavasgam from Vavuniya, Sri Lanka.
An overwhelming 99% voted for independence from Georgia in a referendum held yesterday in the Caucasian breakaway region of South Ossetia. In the same vote, the de facto South Ossetian president won a second term in office. Deborah Wild has the story.
50,000 registered voters were asked whether South Ossetia should maintain its status as independent state and as such seek international recognition. It was the republic's second plebiscite since it broke with Georgia in the beginning of the 1990s. In both cases, the answer was overwhelmingly in the affirmative. The United States, the European Union and NATO have condemned the elections as a step towards further escalation. The Kremlin, however, said that the results of the referendum should be taken into consideration. Neither the elections nor the referendum have been recognized in the international community. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Deborah Wild in Tbilisi, Georgia.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
President George W. Bush met today with leaders of the Iraq Study Group. The committee is chaired by James Baker, a Republican who served as Secretary of State when Bush's father was president, and former Democratic Representative Lee Hamilton of Indiana. President Bush spoke to reporters after his meeting with the Iraq Study Group.
I'm not sure what the report is going to say. I'm looking forward to seeing it.
One approach reportedly being considered by the committee is for Washington to begin talks with Iran and Syria on how to best improve the situation in Iraq. The White House has opposed such a move.
I believe it is very important, though, for people making suggestions to recognize that the best military options depend upon the conditions on the ground.
On the Sunday chat show's top Democratic senators said they're going to push George Bush to begin redeploying troops from Iraq by the middle of next year. But the same lawmakers say they would not be willing to end funding for the war to force such a withdrawal. But as Mitch Jesserich reports, there is a small group of Democrats who are willing to do so.
Democratic Senator Carl Levin of Michigan, likely the next chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee, and Senator Harry Reid, who will likely become Senate Majority Leader in January, say they'll introduce a resolution calling for the redeployment of troops out of Iraq within 4 to 6 months. Senator Levin spoke on ABC's This Week.
And we're going to urge the president on a bipartisan basis, hopefully, to change course in Iraq by doing a number of things, not only telling the Iraqis that we're not there in an open-ended way, but also to set some milestones here so that we can begin to withdraw in 4 to 6 months.
But when asked, Levin said that he would not use his chairship of the Senate Armed Services Committee to stop funding the war, so to force a pullout.
I think that there's significant pressure on this president, given the election results and other factors, that he will in fact change course.
However, there is a small number of progressive Democrats who are willing to take that step.
The president said, I'll be glad to work with the Democrats as long as they agree with my goal to win in Iraq. Well, now that's what he's been saying all along.
Democratic Representative Lynn Woolsey of California is one of them.
I would support as a last ditch effort, if that's the only thing we can do to make the president wake up to the fact that he needs to be bringing our troops home, then indeed that's what happened with Vietnam. That's when it all turned around. It's when the Congress said no more funds.
What about other Democrats? Actually, you're the first Democrat I've heard, that I've talked to anyways, who has indicated that even as a last resort, they would support cutting funding for the war.
Well,
but a lot of other Democrats aren't saying that right now.
Well, no, of course, a lot of other Democrats, of course, they aren't saying it. They don't want to have to say it. Who wants to say that? But Jim McGovern has a legislation that 20 of us have signed on to that says cut the funds.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jesserich in New York.
James Longley is an independent filmmaker who lived in Iraq through the first 2 years of the occupation. His film, Iraq in Fragments, won Best Director and Best Cinematography at Sundance. He's not optimistic that a change of power in Congress will mean much for the people of Iraq.
I actually hesitate to believe that it's going to make any real difference, at least not in the short term in Iraq. I really don't see the Democrats turning around and suddenly coming up with a completely different policy for that.
Why is that?
Well, because, you know, what exactly are they going to do? Are they going to pull out of the country? No, they're not going to pull out of the country. I've heard people saying, well, what we really need is more troops, you know, we need to... Everyone is taking the line that, you know, we have to stabilize the country, and by that they mean build up the army, build up the Iraqi police, and then they can only then could they talk about actually removing U.S. troops. And the Democrats are in that camp as well as the Republicans, so I really don't see a big movement toward a pullout, and a pullout would be the only really significant change of course that I could imagine.
In her victory speech on Wednesday, Nancy Pelosi, the presumed Speaker of the House, talked about the importance of Iraq disarming its own militias. In your film, you show the militia of Muqtada Sadr, one of the largest Shiite militias in the country. Your reaction to Nancy Pelosi's statement?
There are problems within problems within problems. I mean, they've talked about disarming the militias before. In fact, they went through a whole show of doing so back in 2004 with Muqtada's militia. But, you know, as we can see, that didn't really have any actual effect. I mean, the same with, I don't know, the siege and destruction of Fallujah to get rid of insurgents. Well, guess what, you know, the insurgents are back in Fallujah. So none of these policies are actually effective in doing what they're supposed to be doing, at least, you know, what we're told they're supposed to be doing. And I think the same is true with disarming militias. The militias exist in Iraq because of a power vacuum where there's no effective central government. There is no effective central government because the United States' presence in the country is frankly splitting the country politically, and there's no way to form a national government that would have a broad consensus while the United States is there, because the United States is seen as propping up, their very unpopular occupation, propping up a government.
James Longley lived in Iraq through the first 2 years of the occupation. His film Iraq in Fragments opened nationwide last Friday. President Bush met with the Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert today for the first time since Israel's invasion of Lebanon. The meeting came just 2 days after the U.S. vetoed a United Nations Security Council resolution condemning an Israeli military attack on Gaza, which killed 19 civilians. Nan McCurdy has more from Washington.
According to Jennifer Mizrahi, president of the Israel Project, an organization that educates people about Israel with very close ties to Israel, the meeting focused on security challenges.
With situations on the north where weapons are still coming in through Syria to the Hezbollah terrorists that recently had a war with Israel, they're discussing the security challenges in the south where Hamas has still not recognized Israel. And most important on the agenda is a conversation about Iran.
On Saturday, the United States vetoed a UN Security Council resolution that condemned Israel's recent attack on the Gaza town of Beit Hanun that killed at least 19 Palestinian civilians, including 7 children, the youngest only a year old, as well as wounding dozens of other civilians. The resolution called for Israeli troops to pull out of Gaza and end operations in all Palestinian lands. It also urged the international community to take steps to stabilize the situation, revive the Middle East peace process, and consider the possible establishment of an international mechanism for the protection of civilians. John Bolton, United States Ambassador to the United Nations, said the resolution did not paint an even-handed picture of the situation in the Middle East.
We are disturbed at the language of the resolution that is in many places biased against Israel and politically motivated. Such language does not further the cause of peace.
Dr. Moura El-Faraz, a physician in northern Gaza who works with the Middle East Children's Alliance. She describes the Israel Defense Forces attack on the town of Beit Hanun in northern Gaza as shameful.
But what I have seen in our emergency room at Al Auda Hospital is beyond imagination, beyond words. Bloodiest day in the history of my hospital.
Asked about the U.S. veto of the U.N. resolution to condemn Israel for the attack, she responded.
We know that Israel wouldn't have the free hand to do what they are doing with us in Gaza Strip without the full financial, military, and political support of the U.S.
Jennifer Mizrahi of the Israeli Project.
Unfortunately, and quite tragically, one of their attempts to try and stop these racket attempts from coming into Israel tragically went dramatically off the place where they were trying to hit some terrorists and killed some innocent people. And it is a terrible, terrible tragedy. The Prime Minister and the Foreign Minister of Israel have apologized.
Ali Abunima, author of the new book, One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse, commented on what he thinks Prime Minister Olmert and President Bush should be talking about.
What they should be talking about is Israel's ongoing assault on Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Since June, Israeli occupation forces have killed over 400 Palestinians, more than half of them civilians, and over 75 of them children. All the observers who have looked at the situation confirm what Palestinians are saying, that there is indiscriminate artillery fire against Palestinian towns and communities. All of this is ongoing, and it is no surprise that Israel does this because the U.S. refuses to put any pressure on Israel whatsoever to stop.
From Washington, D.C., for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nan McCurdy.
Tensions remain high in Mexico's southern state of Oaxaca, where federal police have been brought in to quell months of protests against the governor. Over the weekend, the Popular Assembly of the People of Oaxaca, which represents teachers, trade unionists, and others opposed to Governor Ulises Ruiz, wrapped up a three-day planning meeting to decide the future of their struggle. The social movement in Oaxaca continues to receive visits from solidarity caravans from other parts of the country. Vladimir Flores reports from Oaxaca City.
An estimated 1,000 representatives of indigenous communities, municipalities, poor neighborhoods, unions, and social organizations met in Oaxaca City over the weekend for the Constituent Congress of the Popular Assembly of the People of Oaxaca to discuss the formation of a new government and a new constitution for Oaxaca. Flavio Sosa of the Leadership Council of the Popular Assembly, or APO, explained some of the objectives of this weekend's Congress.
Fortalecer a la APO, ampliar su presencia a todo el estado.
To strengthen the APO, to broaden its presence throughout the entire state, to create an organic structure for us, to create basic documents that were necessary for us to lay out exactly where the movement is going and what profile we want for our organization.
El perfil de organización que seremos.
Oaxacans living and working in the United States play an important role within the popular movement against Governor Ulises Ruiz. Money sent by migrant workers to relatives back home represents one of the main sources of revenue for Oaxaca's economy. Official data suggests that around 10% of Oaxacans live and work outside of the state. Abel Sanchez represents an organization of migrants and comments on the importance of Oaxacans living in California.
Es debido que en la ciudad de Los Ángeles radica una comunidad oaxaqueña muy importante.
A very important Oaxacan community is based in the city of Los Angeles, which in these moments has been carrying out acts of protest in front of the Mexican consulate, denouncing the repression that is being used here in Oaxaca.
The actions of solidarity with the popular movement continue this weekend with the arrival of huge caravans from Mexico City and Chiapas. Approximately 250 members of the indigenous civil society group Las Abejas arrived in Oaxaca City to perform religious ceremonies in favor of peace, as this man explains during an action in front of Oaxaca's cathedral, which was surrounded by hundreds of federal riot police. Las Abejas organization is largely composed of survivors of the 1997 massacre in Acteal, Chiapas.
We're nearly done with our prayer ceremony and fast, which we began in Chiapas. We don't want any more death. We don't want more massacres like what happened in Acteal and other parts of the country. Our commitment is to build peace among everyone so that there can be democracy in our country, Mexico.
Even the country's main opposition party has jumped into the fray. Oaxacan legislators from the PRD party ended their hunger strike in Mexico City inside of the Senate building and announced plans to carry out more radical actions in various parts of Oaxaca, including the blockading of highways to demand the dissolution of the state government. With Tim Russo, I am Vladimir Flores in Oaxaca City for Free Speech Radio News.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. You can go to our website, www.fsrn.org. To hear this newscast or anything else in our archives, go to www.fsrn.org. Tensions are high in the Congolese capital, Kinshasa, as results show incumbent President Joseph Kabila headed to victory in presidential elections. Results posted today on the website of the Congo Independent Electoral Commission show Kabila leading with 60% against Jean-Pierre Bemba after 90% of the count. Joshua Kilimpa reports from neighboring Uganda.
The elections have sharply divided the vast Central African nation along tribal lines. Kabila has enormous support from the Swahili-speaking tribes in the east of the country, which has been affected by the long-running war in the country. The Bangala are the ethnic tribe that is mostly found in the west of the Congo, and they speak a local dialect called Lingala. Mlela John, a voter from the east of DR Congo, feels this is the time for an Easterner to lead the country.
For me, I want Kabila be president in my country, because the another part of our country, we think the presidency must be just a Mungala. We are tired with the Bangala. We want now to change another person. We want Kabila. We want Kabila. Our last president, who is calling Mobutu. Mobutu is Mungala. He do 32 years in the power. In our country, there is nothing is working well. Now we want to development of our country.
Mlela's opinion is echoed by many people in the east of the DR Congo. Job Ayub, a resident of Bunia in the Ituri region of Congo, says he is happy Kabila is in the lead.
Well, I'm voting for Kabila. I'm happy, and many Congolese also is happy, because the Ituri region is the region who many people are killing in the war. Now people inside of Kinshasa cannot see every Congolese, cannot vote for war again in Congo. People want peace. Any president coming in Congo for what everybody can refuse, because Kabila is what peace.
The people in Eastern DR Congo see Kabila as a symbol of peace. Years under dictator Mobutu have made the Easterners hate the Lingala-speaking Westerners. And while this has been the undoing for Bemba, it is also problematic for Kabila. The people in the capital Kinshasa are largely the Bangala, and Kabila is very unpopular there. The city has seen numerous clashes since the first elections took place. Fighters wrote the two men clashed after the first round of voting, and 23 people were killed in gun battles in Kinshasa in late July. Mr. Bemba's supporters have repeatedly said electoral fraud has damaged their candidates' chances. Tensions run high in Kinshasa, and the government has threatened to deploy the army on the streets if the unrest continues. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Joshua Charimpa reporting from Uganda.
Today, Australia and Indonesia signed a historic security treaty, which will see increased cooperation on anti-terrorism measures, border security and intelligence sharing, as well as guarantee Australian support for the development of nuclear energy in Indonesia. Of major concern is a clause that requires both countries to recognize each other's territorial integrity. Supporters of the West Papuan independence movement are very concerned that in signing this clause, Australia effectively denies the rights of many within the province who want independence or at least autonomy from the central government in Jakarta. Erica Voles reports from Sydney.
I think the important thing is that we recognize the coexistence between two nations. The relationship should be amicable, but we think, as conscious West Papuans, as nationalists, we think that the closure on West Papua should be deleted from the security treaty agreement.
That was former West Papuan politician and independence activist Willem Zonganau. In September this year, he and fellow West Papuan Clemens Ranawari travelled to Australia to plead the federal government not to sideline West Papuan independence in any security pact with Indonesia. Shortly after giving this interview, Willem died, far from his homeland. Those carrying on the struggle for West Papuan self-determination remain concerned that his plea appears to have fallen on deaf ears. Dr. Clinton Fernandez of the Australian Defence Force Academy says the pact has little to do with security. He remains opposed to it because he says the Australian government is ignoring the wishes of 75% of the population that support the right of West Papuans to determine their own future.
The pact is really about reassuring Indonesia's military leadership that Australia does not support an independent West Papua. On the issue of drug smuggling and terrorism, I think there are genuine concerns. However, this is best solved by cross-border police cooperation, cross-border intelligence sharing, and a lot of investigation.
The Lowy Institute's Dr. Malcolm Cook, who is supportive of the pact, also believes it has less to do with security than it does with allaying the fears within Indonesia that Australia supports an independent West Papua.
It looks like there will be some scope, for example, for Australia to encourage through the treaty and for Indonesia to take stronger action against groups within Indonesia that may pose a threat to Australia. Jamaat Islamiyah is the one that comes first to mind. I don't think this treaty is very much about strengthening Australia's security, or in that case Indonesia's. I think it's more about getting over some of the mutual recriminations that the two countries have had.
Reverend John Barr is one of the few foreigners to gain entry into West Papua, and he was there 2 weeks ago. He says most living there would be happy to settle for a form of autonomy that really empowered West Papuans. But despite Indonesian legislation, in reality, this has not happened. So with autonomy failing, he says Papuans will be suspicious of Australia's move.
I think for most Papuans, they see Australia as a friend and a place that can be trusted. I think that could undermine some of that feeling now.
Due to a lack of access by journalists and human rights workers to the province, it's difficult to ascertain the true situation facing West Papuans. However, in his recent book, Reluctant Indonesians, Australia, Indonesia and the Future of West Papua, Clinton Fernandez argues that Indigenous West Papuans face daily discrimination and abuse at the hands of the Indonesian security forces.
The Papuans are basically not regarded in the same light as other Indonesians because of the colour of their skin. My research says that the most severe beatings in police custody tend to be administered to West Papuans who are blacker than usual, or have bigger heads, or have more negroid features. Racism and racial beatings are a real factor in the way the Indonesian military and police operate in West Papua.
But with the signing of the security pact, is there going to be a marked change on the ground for West Papuans?
Well, the conditions aren't going to improve, that's for sure. And to a certain extent, they might deteriorate, but not substantially. Very recently, the military commander of West Papua was replaced, and the new person is Major General Zamroni. When Zamroni came in, he came in with a track record from Aceh. During his time in Aceh, Indonesia's own assessments were that an average of 7 civilians died per day for the year that he was in Aceh.
This is Erica Voles in Sydney, reporting for FSRN.
Free Speech Radio News was produced today by Nell Abram and Simba Russo, with headlines editor Shannon Young, Washington editor Lee Ann Caldwell, and myself, Aaron Glantz. Eric Klein is our technical director. Antonio Ortiz is our technical producer. Please join us again tomorrow for another edition of Free Speech Radio News.
This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of The Progressive Magazine, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also listen to over at progressive.org. Today we're going to be looking back at the elections, Donald Rumsfeld's resignation, but also at the Iraq War and George Bush's foreign policy through a feminist lens. With me to talk about this is Cynthia Enloe, professor of international development, community and social change, as well as women's studies at Clark University in Worcester, Mass. Cynthia Enloe is the author most recently of The Curious Feminist, Searching for Women in the New Age of Empire. Cynthia Enloe, welcome back to Progressive Radio.
It's nice to
Radio.
Be here, Matt.
It's great to see you again. What was your reaction to the elections?
Well, I have to admit, I was quite buoyed by them. You know, I had the feeling that at least there was a crack in the monolith. And I think that's a good thing. I don't think I'm under any illusions that the Democrats are going to be a wildly progressive party as organized in Congress, and they're more diverse than ever. But, you know, it will make a difference. And if Nancy Pelosi really does follow through on one of her promises, which is that there'll be a lot of investigations, not only of the Iraq War, but of Katrina and of money spent on contractors, then in fact we may find out things that we otherwise hadn't, and perhaps the general public will learn some of the background that they have not been attentive to.
I sure hope she does issue those subpoenas, but I know she's under a lot of pressure from the pundits and from the so-called moderates and the people who are playing the angles already for 2008 that, you know, the Democrats should just sit on their hands and not issue subpoenas on or on the Iraq War or Halliburton, for instance, or impeachment, which is what I think John Conyers should be allowed to pursue.
Yeah, well, I think one of the things to watch is is how much misogynist reporting there is, even by innuendo, of Pelosi.
Did you think Bush's comment at his recent press conference the day after, saying changing the drapery in the speaker's office was sexist?
Well, of course. I mean, it's just classic, you know. But I think there's going to be a lot worse than that.
What do you expect?
I think there will be implicit remarks about whether – watch for the words shrill. Watch for the words – they won't use hysterical with Pelosi. You can't. She's very, very controlled. But watch for all those kind of feminized, delegitimizing words. I think that she's going to be under a kind of pressure that Hastert never experienced.
Do you think she's up to it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think she's very smart. As I saw one commentator say, that she's San Francisco on the inside, but Baltimore on the outside.
Have you ever met her?
Well, no, I've never met her. No, I've never met her. No,
tell me
she's tough, I think.
She seems tough. Tell me what your reaction to Donald Rumsfeld's resignation was.
Well, you know, Matt, I think of at least all my pals that we immediately talked to each other when the news came out. I'm the only one, I think, that's disappointed. I actually didn't want Rumsfeld to be forced to resign.
Why?
I wanted him front and center. I wanted him to be right there so that you can't forget him. I think that, in fact, this is doing the Bush administration a favor to have him out of the picture. I think Gates, who they're bringing in now, will be much more palatable. He won't make any mistakes. He's not a bland person intellectually, but he'll come across as a good civil servant.
You know, bland, it's interesting. I think, you know, they've exchanged a brazen manipulator for a bland manipulator.
Yeah. Gates is very, very smart. I mean, he comes out of the CIA. You know, he's very, very good. And he won't ruffle the senior command as much. That's one of the reasons why they got rid of Rumsfeld, I think, is because it was not us types who got him out. It was the senior military officers, both recently retired and active duty. No, I'm not happy necessarily about Rumsfeld's leaving.
Now, Rumsfeld typified, according to an article of yours that I saw, I think it was in an interview you did with Doug Henwood of Left Business Review or Left Business Observer, that Rumsfeld typified a kind of macho masculinity that was on display for the first 6 years of the Bush administration. Do you want to describe that?
Well, I think it's quite combative. I think it also plays the sort of I'm more masculine than you game with other men. I mean, from the books I've read describing Rumsfeld's behavior inside the Pentagon, he constantly is creating hierarchies of masculinity with the men around the table with him, and really quite deliberately playing a game of humiliation.
You called it feminizing, that he tried to feminize Colin Powell.
Yes, right. I think the State Department gets feminized. I think in our politics, the State Department is oftentimes feminized by the Defense Department. And that's not just this administration. It's looking down on people who don't wield weapons. It's a real dynamic in American politics, I think.
It's also looking down on people who listen and people who negotiate. That those skills are somehow not worthy.
Yes, and then you paint that with not looking after American interests. You know, if you listen in Nigeria or you listen in South Korea, somehow you are less patriotic. So you combine that with the wielding of feminization, and you've got quite an effective way of dismissing the State Department, which, you know, the State Department is not always high on my list of admirable institutions, but I think that game is played.
What about Bush himself and his peculiar personality and the way he displays his own masculinity or the way he deals with all that?
Well, you know, I think it matters. I actually try really hard not to just keep track of the kind of masculinity that's, if you will, on display in public forums. I'm really quite interested in the kind of more structural institutionalized masculinity. So there are people who are very good observers of kind of the parade of masculinity, and I think that matters. But I'm really interested in how it plays out behind the scenes or in policy debates, in actual policies. So I think, yes, I think there's no question but that George W. Has tried to wield masculinity. I think it's come around to, this is mixed metaphors, to bite him, though. Because when you parade masculinity and then it looks as though you're not effective, it looks like real sham.
And institutionally, then, at the focus that you like to stay at, how is masculinity so much a part and influence in policy institutionally?
Well, I think in the recent years, it's really been this notion, it's been played out in this notion of a kind of militarized foreign policy is the only genuine expression of protection of American interests. And when you combine militarization, and this is being done by civilians primarily, and the wielding of masculinity, you really paint the American public into a box. But, I mean, it's not just men, it's also women who oftentimes find this appealing. I mean, I'm very interested in this most recent election to see the exit polls. The recent ones I've heard of, but I haven't seen all the analysis yet, is that married women's moved on this one. That was a very prominent demographic in 2004, and they moved away from the, if you will, the security mom tendency or appeal. But the other thing that one we should all watch for is that the exit polls show that married men moved even more than married women. Married men, according to, now this is the early exit polling analysis, split 50-50, Democrats and Republicans. That's news. That is, married men are usually who the Republicans can count on.
And how do you explain the move?
Well, I don't know yet, but I think we should all, I mean, it's very interesting. Why should marriage have such an impact on the way men imagine their interests? Right? Does it really, you know, plug into their notion of being protectors or being the most adult people in the public sphere, which I think maybe, but I think we have to ask, we should ask all the married men we'd know, did they switch their vote and why?
And it may be that it relates also to just the right track, wrong track numbers that were so lopsided in feeling that the country's going down the tubes in a hurry, and that married men, especially if they have children, are not going to want to leave the country in worse shape to their kids than it is right now. And for one of the first times in American history, a lot of the married men and women think that's what's going to happen. And that,
yeah,
and that shrinking horizon is real sadness for this country, don't you think?
Oh, yes, I think it is. I mean, the group that has gotten it right, I mean, big demographic group that has gotten it right, correctly, I should say, has been unmarried women. Unmarried women have been the most solid Democratic base. The absolutely most solid Democratic base is unmarried African American women. They are the most reliable voters, and I often, when I look at how they break out and express their attitudes towards particular policies, I'm almost always with them. I always think, gosh, if single African American women ran the country, we'd be in really good shape.
The pollster Celinda Lake has been studying this population, this demographic of unmarried single women. I don't know if she focuses on African American single women. What is it about unmarried single women that makes them the most reliably Democratic demographic?
Well, one thing seems to be that they are out there earning a living, and they actually have a good handle on what insecurity looks like and what kinds of public policies engender insecurity. And so I think they are much more protected against the kind of terrorism appeal, I mean, the anti-terrorism appeal. I think they tend to be quite down to earth in their notions about public policy. That's my sense, anyway.
What about choice? Is that a big part there, too?
I think it probably is quite a big part of it, but I think it's as much economics.
Interesting. Cynthia Enloe is my guest today. She is a professor of international development, community, and social change, as well as women's studies at Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts. She's the author, most recently, of The Curious Feminist, Searching for Women in the new age of empire. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine. Cynthia, you've been giving a lecture recently entitled Where Are the Women in the U.S. War in Iraq and Why Does It Matter? Do you want to clue us in?
In 30 seconds or less. Well, you know what I've been doing, Matt? Ever since the war began, well, actually in Iraq, I've been just trying to keep my eye on women in Afghanistan and women in Iraq, as well as those women in the U.S. who the militarizers, as I call them, the war wagers, absolutely count on. So in this country, I'm very attentive to, doesn't mean I know enough, but I'm very attentive to women who are military wives, married to soldiers, and women who are mothers of soldiers. I really keep track of them, and because governments can't wage wars if they lose the backing of military wives or mothers of soldiers. That could delegitimize a war waging effort faster than anything. But in Iraq, I keep track of those women who are trying to organize. There's something like 200 different Iraqi women's organizations now, and we hear about none of them.
What is the plight of Iraqi women right now?
What you hear primarily, and I haven't been to Iraq, and so I'm, you know, hearing this second and third hand, but what you hear primarily is that in the years of 03, 04, early 05, when there was still some effort to create new political parties, a new constitutional government, and a new constitution, that there was a great debate amongst women, sometimes very publicly and sometimes just privately, about what the new family code would be, what the new laws, sometimes called the personal laws, would be. And not all women are quite divided, evidently, quite understandably, it's quite complex, about how much Islamic principles should inform the new state law. Under the Saddam Hussein regime, in his early years, it was quite a secularized personal law around custody and divorce and women's independence. As Saddam Hussein in the 90s was under such pressure, because of the loss of the first Gulf War, but also because of the toll that the economic sanctions were taking, he tried to gain more support from more religious conservatives, and he then brought some of those conservative ideas into his own public policy. So women were looking at first to try and understand how much the Islamic principles should inform the new public law. Then there was also a debate about whether Sharia, which is Islamic law, particularly around family affairs, should be made part of state law. And what has recently happened is there's no space to even have those debates now. Now, women in Iraq, from what I understand, are so preoccupied with just physical security that has taken over everything. So it's really pushed them out of the public space at a very time when they had very serious debates that they had to take part in. And now it's increasingly difficult to even have any public presence because of the deterioration of security.
That's a real indictment of Bush's Iraq war that we don't hear very often. And he brags about liberating everyone in Iraq. He brags about liberating women in Afghanistan and in Iraq, whereas the situation is quite different. The starting situation was quite different in the two places. Actually, in Iraq, it seems to have gone back. Backwards. How about in Afghanistan?
In Afghanistan, again, it depends on the province you're in. If you're down south, if you're in Helmand and the provinces where now the insurgency is raging again, you're very likely as a woman to really feel as though you're going backwards. And I mean even going backwards from 2001, 2002. A lot of parents have pulled their daughters out of school, not because they don't believe in education, but because it's too frightening to send their daughters to school. In some other provinces, the real problem is that the warlords, these are who we used to call the Northern Alliance, the United States government, first backed, those warlords are almost as conservative as the Taliban. And so for a lot of women, they're under new strictures in those provinces as well.
And some of them are working with the Taliban right now, I understand. But
especially around the drug trade, around opium.
Right. You talked about a second ago, Cynthia Enloe, about the Pentagon being, the war makers being very concerned about the attitudes of women and of mothers of soldiers. You wrote in or said in something I was reading while I was preparing for this that Mother's politicization is making the Pentagon nervous. Its recruiting command and ad agencies have invested millions of dollars to retool ads that target mothers of potential recruits. Have you seen any of those retooled ads?
Oh, yes. The ad agency that got the big Army account. And, you know, the Defense Department is really one of the choice accounts to get if you are a advertising agency. The ad agency that got the Army recruiting account is called Leo Barnett.
Out of Chicago, I think.
Out of Chicago. And Leo Barnett has produced some very subtle, sophisticated ads directed right at mothers of young men. They're particularly, most of the ads really aim at young men. If they get young women, fine, but the ad target group is the mothers of sons.
And how are they tugging at mothers there?
Two things. One, to encourage mothers to think that this is a way for their sons to get a paid education, which in fact, if you call the GI hotline and other helplines, you'll find that it's very hard to get the benefits promised for higher education. And the second is that this will make your son more adult and more independent, make him, quote-unquote, a man. And sometimes that's exactly the language used in the ads. And it really plays on mothers' concern that their 18- or 19-year-old, or maybe even 17 if they're being recruited early, that their son become adult, that he become mature. And lots of mothers, of course, wish for that. If the recruiter can say, this is one way I can help you parent your son from adolescence into adulthood, that can be made to seem quite appealing. They're having the hardest time with Latino mothers, however, because a lot of Latino mothers are of a generation that when they think militaries, they think the Guatemalan military, they think the Honduran military, and they are much harder to make an approach to. So the ad agencies now that are working for the Pentagon have a whole stream of advertising aimed just at Latino mothers.
It's interesting. They're also advertising, I guess it's spring break. It's another thing they're doing that I didn't know about. But the mother's angle, I mean, there are a lot of activist mothers now who've come out against the war, Cindy Sheehan, of course, being the most obvious. Tell me about her role and the role of other dissenting mothers.
Well, I was very fortunate just a couple of weeks ago to appear with Cindy Sheehan. We look like Mutt and Jeff. Your radio listeners can't see it, but I'm only 5'2", and Cindy is... Gosh, I think she must be at least 5'8", 5'9". So we looked
at
Syracuse. The folks at Syracuse held a wonderful conference called Feminism and War. It was just terrific. And they had the two of us on to begin. I mean, Cindy Sheehan was the star. But it was very interesting. She's a very modest person. I had never met her before. Very modest in her demeanor, in the way she approaches people come up to her who are full of admiration. She's very, very committed. She's very strong. You can see that. I mean, I think she always has been quite politically conscious. I think she's not a naive. I think oftentimes women who become politically active around war issues are portrayed as if they had never had a political thought in their head before, and then only out of their maternal inclinations do they become politically engaged.
Right, this is what O'Reilly was saying. She's a tool to the left. She doesn't know what she's
everybody's
doing.
Everybody's a tool.
She's being manipulated.
Exactly.
There was more sexism, Cynthia Enloe, in the descriptions of her other than just being naive. I mean, there were some really nasty, ugly, disgusting, misogynistic things said about her, particularly on the web.
Yes, well, I think misogyny really is a tool for political discourse when they're dealing with women who otherwise are admirable in American culture. And the grieving mother of a, quote, fallen soldier is very hard to get at. And so what you have to do is you have to isolate her. You have to make sure that all her credentials that usually legitimize a woman, that is her motherhood, her grief, her son being in the military, that you have to knock all those pins out from under her. And I think it's really a sign of how nervous they are about motherhood in politics.
It's also a sign of how strong she is to have withstood that.
She is very resilient. She's had a lot of support from people like Leslie Kagan, who's a longtime anti-war activist, and also the Code Pink activist. It's been just great, I mean, to watch other people come around. Now, of course, here's the fine line. She has legitimacy with a lot of Americans if she can look as though she stands all by herself and has no political alliances and no political connections at all. If she is really just the lone mother out there expressing her grief. If she begins to be seen to have support, which she deserves, from Code Pink or from some other activists, then that is used by the O'Reillys, but others, against her. And even by ordinary people who first sympathize with her think, oh, well, she is part of a movement. Now I can make a judgment about a whole movement. She's not as legitimate as she was in my, you know, ordinary viewer's eyes when I thought she was just all by herself.
So it takes political agency away from her.
Yes.
What about Code Pink? How effective have they been, do you think?
I think they're very very good at public actions. They know how to get attention, and given how difficult it's been for anybody to get any kind of attention for any kind of public actions. I mean, you all know, if you've been at a rally recently and then you try to see whether it's ever covered by local or regional or national press, it isn't. And they've managed to really do a lot. I think partly because they're very witty. I heard Medea Benjamin speak, and she said, you know, I have never worn pink. Right? Pink is not my color, but if that's what it takes, you know. So I think it's because they've got a lot of autonomy in their local actions, and because they've got a great sense of humor, as well as they're willing to be outrageous.
I'm speaking with Cynthia Enloe, who is a professor of international development, community and social change out at Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts, also a professor of women's studies and the author most recently of The Curious Feminist, Searching for Women in the New Age of Empire. Cynthia Enloe, you talked a little bit ago about women in Afghanistan and in Iraq. What about women soldiers in the U.S. Army over there? What is life like for them?
Yeah, well, the news that your listeners probably realize that the U.S. military is now up to about 15% women in the active duty, but it's as high as 24% in the reserves and the National Guard. So it's really quite a different profile, and it matters that reservists and National Guard are being sent over. What we're hearing is a lot of, well, there's several things. One, women, there have now been 65 women, U.S. Military women killed in Iraq. 65 out of now close to 2,800. But there have been a lot of women seriously injured. There are women who are amputees, women American soldiers who are amputees. There was, the first thought was that that would mean that policymakers would pull the rug. As soon as the first woman amputee was shown in a national newspaper, in fact, they would not be deployed. But that's not true. And I think that a lot of ordinary American citizens just do not see women as somehow always the protected now, that they can take the risks. On the other hand, one of the big risks that women face inside the U.S. military is being sexually assaulted by their own male peers. And this has barely gotten much attention. There are mounting figures now as to how many women have come forward. It's very risky to come forward, if you're a woman, to your next superior officer and say that you've been sexually harassed or even assaulted. So it takes a lot of guts for these women to come forward, but they're not getting much support from their own commanders.
Cynthia Enloe, some of those stories are just horrifying, too. I know that Janice Karpinski, who was running Abu Ghraib there for a bit and was the only officer there who was really disciplined, she reported that women soldiers, a couple of them anyway, died of dehydration after exercises in the hot heat because they were too afraid to go out and get water for fear of being raped by their own colleagues.
One of the things that Karpinski said is that when she went to General Sanchez And of course she was a general, and he's a general, but he was her superior in Iraq, and when he was the commander of Iraq forces, and went to him and his second in command, another senior officer, and said that she was getting reports of either threats of assault or actual assault on her women troops. Of course she was commanding a mixed men and women's unit. She was told at the central command in Baghdad, well, you wanted to be here, get used to it. So no understanding of how much this violated military discipline or undermined military morale.
It's not exactly the welcome mat, is it?
No, it isn't. On the other hand, the U.S. military now depends on women. So they have a great stake in keeping these stories quiet. Warner, the other senator from Virginia, actually did become quite outraged when it was combined with stories of rape at the U.S. Air Force Academy, and did hold at least some hearings. And there's some move at some levels in the State Department, in the Defense Department, to take this seriously. But at the field command, a lot of commanders do not want to hear it, and then they actually blame the victim.
There were the stories of sexual harassment are amazing too. I know Suzanne Swift, who said she was guilty. She was a victim of command rape, and also said when she asked her commanding officer where she should report for duty, he said, in my bed. I mean, that is about as flagrant as it goes. And to hear, as you reported, Cynthia and Lowe, that the commanding officers view it as nothing, total minimization, is horrifying. Unfortunately, we're out of time. My guest today on Progressive Radio has been Cynthia Enloe, Professor of International Development, Community and Social Change, as well as Women's Studies at Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts. Her latest book, The Curious Feminist, Searching for Women in the New Age of Empire. Cynthia Enloe, it's great to see you again.
Matt, it's always nice to be here.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth Di Novella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.
KBOO Community Radio is looking for a full-time evening news and public affairs director. We're looking for someone with news and public affairs skills, writing, editing, production, and training experience in working with volunteers. The job requires the ability to work under deadlines, to work under pressure, and to work evening hours. The ability to work with a wide variety of people in a multicultural and cooperative environment is essential. For more information and to get a job application, please contact Chris Merrick, care of News Director Hiring Committee at KBOO, or go online at www.kboo.fm for an online job description. KBOO is an equal employment opportunity employer. Deadline is Friday, November the 17th.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Teamsters Local 206, helping Oregon's working families fight for good jobs and a better future. For information about how the Teamsters can help you win respect at work, the number is 503-251-2344. And also by AFSCME Local 88, protecting worker rights and fighting to improve the wages and working conditions of members who work for Multnomah County, Central City Concern, Transition Projects, and American Friends Service Committee. More information at 503-239-9858 or www.local88.ws. This KBOO.
Good evening and welcome to KBOO. This is Mary Beth Healy and I'm your co-host this evening for Labor Radio, along with Don McIntosh. And we are really excited to be here. We're going to have a stellar program. And basically the topic today is America Votes. And 1 week later, what does it mean? And what does it mean for working people? So we're here today in studio with Kari Chisholm, who is a local political consultant here in the Portland metro area, and also a fabulous internet strategist. And we will be discussing with he and Martin Taylor later on in the show the impacts of the elections, what it means for working people. And we would also open up the phone lines in a little bit for your comments and thoughts about what do the 2006 elections mean for you. So, Kari, I would just start off and open it up to you. What is your thoughts around how last Tuesday impacts working people?
Oh, man, it was a great election, wasn't it?
It was a great election.
You know, we've been talking about how we just can't stop smiling. This election was an extraordinary one. Maybe one of the top one or two of my lifetime, my political career. It just strikes me that everywhere, at every level, from the national to the state to the local, from candidates to ballot measures, you know, not only did Democrats do well, but I think working people did pretty well. This election.
You know, it was really interesting to me, and I'd be curious what you think, and that is really that Oregonians spoke, I think Americans spoke, and pretty loud and clear, and we're hacked off and we want something done. But it was very interesting to me watching the ballot measure results and what that means. I mean, voters said we want to keep our elected officials and have term limits be the elections, or elections be term limits, as the phrase was, which I think is really fabulous. Oregonians said, we're not going to tie your hands on funding issues, and we're going to trust you. Okay, trust might be too strong, but we're going to give you the tools that you need to be an effective lawmaker and do the job that we elect you to do. Am I off track here?
Well, I think that certainly you know, there was a lot of debate before the election as to whether it was an anti-incumbent year or whether it was an anti-Republican year, an anti-conservative year. And I think that particularly here in Oregon, given that people smacked down the term limits measure, it's pretty clear it wasn't an anti-incumbent year. It was an anti-conservative year. You know, they said, we're gonna change who's in control of the Oregon House. We're gonna put Ted Kulongoski back in charge. We're gonna keep the Oregon Senate in the hands of Democrats. And we're not gonna term limit them out. I think the message was really crystal clear here in Oregon.
This is Tom Aktash, by the way. For some listeners may have been expecting Ken Allen. He wasn't able to make it tonight. I'm basically here sitting in for him. But I think, too, that there's a little bit of difference what's going on nationally, maybe, and what's happening in Oregon. Tim Nesbitt was one of the folks I know that Mary Beth, you had hoped to get on tonight's show, wasn't able to make it. Tim is a former head of the Oregon AFL-CIO and a pretty as shrewd a political strategist that the labor movement has locally that we could think of. You know, Tim has a column in I work for the Northwest Labor Press, by the way, nwlaborpress.org. Tim's column in that our next issue talks about the idea of this not being a sneaker wave, what's just happened in Oregon, but rather a rising tide. There's a change really in the sea level, a sea change in what's happening in Oregon. It's really become a blue state, which is probably good for you, Kari, being a blue Oregon, but it's becoming a blue state in a way that I think is going to be significant for years to come. This is not an anomaly in his analysis. Rather, you know, this is something that people like Gordon Smith in 2 years' time are going to have to look at very carefully. How they will stay elected, being basically at this point the only statewide Republican elected official.
You know, I would say there's been this discussion, is Oregon turning red or is Oregon turning blue, red being Republican, blue being Democrat. And, you know, I remember this summer, Willamette Week had their big cover story, and it was largely informed by research done by Our Oregon and Kevin Looper about how Oregon's voting a population is actually turning red. The number of
the
registration numbers, that the number of Democrats is plummeting faster than the number of Republicans is plummeting. And of course, both parties are losing ground to independents. But of course, in the Oregonian over the weekend, Dan Levy, former aide to Gordon Smith, was saying, you know, if you look at voter behavior, not just their registration, it's shifting blue. It's shifting toward the Democratic side. So what we're seeing is the rise of independents at the cost of at the expense of both parties. But those independents are behaving more and more like Democrats, and that's what we're seeing in Washington County. Washington County, I think, had a big coming out party for the Democrats this year in 2006. If you look at just, you know, 10 years ago, I remember when Ryan Deckert was the only legislator in Washington County elected as a Democrat. And now it is almost a solidly Democratic county when we look at the legislature. It's pretty extraordinary the way that Washington County has changed as it's become more high tech, as it's become younger, as people have children there. Those young people have children there. They're committed to their schools. Beaverton School Bond passed, the Hillsborough School Bond passed.
North Clackamas School Bond passed, police levy passed in Clackamas County.
In Clackamas County. I mean, Washington County.
The governor won in Clackamas County.
Washington County has been the leading edge, and Clackamas is now chasing Washington County. It's pretty extraordinary stuff.
Well, and I do think that the thing that I found so interesting really was the, I don't know if trust is the right word at all, but this feeling from voters that we're going to give you the tools that you need. So let's talk about a few elections, Kari. Now I know you were working on one at the very top of the ticket here. So talk to us about the governor's race and what do you think is on his agenda, particularly as it pertains to working folks.
You know, I'm more of a political hack than a policy wonk, but given the great fight between the hacks and the wonks. And so I'll say that, you know, first of all, in terms of election results, Governor Kulongoski's victory was really pretty widespread. It used to be said, well, you know, Democrats would win well, and they'd do well in Corvallis and Eugene and in Portland, go 50-50 in the suburbs, and then they'd lose the rural areas. Well, you know, Governor Kulongoski, he won Wasco County.
Wow.
He won from Astoria to Coos Bay along the coast, the rural coast, Lincoln County, Tillamook County, Columbia County, Coos County. Sorry, not Coos County. Up by Columbia County. Clatsop County, thank you. And of course he did better this year in Multnomah County, running against a Portland lawyer than he did against Kevin Mannix 4 years ago, who was a Salem lawyer. From Marion County. And so to me, what's interesting is the way in which Oregon is trending blue. I think the governor, is going to feel free now. He's run his last campaign, he has said. He doesn't need to ever worry about elections again, and he's going to follow his heart. He's made it very clear. I mean, this was a campaign won on ideas and policies. He talked about the education enterprise. He talked about tax reform. He's going to pursue that agenda, and I think in ways that we can only imagine right now, he's going to be a very grassroots-oriented governor.
Up ahead, of course, again, we're going to be talking with Martin Taylor, who, by the way, is the political person for the Oregon Nurses Association. But I think maybe, Mary Beth, should we give out the number for our listeners to join also at this point?
Yeah, that would be great.
503-231-8187 is the number to call if you want to join us with a question or comment. Basically, again, the topic tonight being last week's election. What the heck happened, and what does it mean for working people?
What does it mean to you? Did you vote? I'd be interested. What was our turnout overall?
It was pretty high. It was about 64-65%, if I remember right, which is a little lower than the estimate than we expected, but still pretty strong.
What was that? Does that hold for the governor's race? How many people voted in the governor's race? Do you know?
I think Mary Beth got the numbers over there. You know, the numbers were high.
One of the interesting things about that I noticed is that it turns out that the number of signatures you need to qualify a ballot measure depend on the number who voted in the governor's race. And I was wondering whether possibly two unpalatable candidates. I mean, Mary Starrett was pretty exciting, but she only got 48,000, right? But I wondered whether that would actually make it easier for ballot measures to flourish in the next couple of years if really there weren't that many people turning out. But it sounds like maybe they did turn out in decent numbers to vote for either Kulongoski or Saxton, most obviously opting for Kulongoski.
If I remember right, looking at some of the numbers, you know, turnout among Democrats was about 10% higher than turnout among Republicans. This was definitely an election, particularly in Oregon, where conservative voters felt disenchanted and let down by their leadership, and progressive voters were coming out in droves to send a message.
I believe that to be true. It was actually 66.93% turnout, so 67%.
Right.
Not so bad. And I also like to think that that these ballot measures, again, I don't want to overlook them, because I think what they did to help direct the new incoming legislature, this will be the first time that the Democrats have controlled the House of Representatives in this state in 16 years, will the elected officials kind of take the not the mandate, but the instruction from the voters to move forward on policies
I think it's just so impressive to me that we kept saying on Tuesday night as we were watching the results roll in, you know, could it be actually possible that Oregon voters finally understand that Oregon is now 50th in corporate taxation, that our tax structure looks, our revenues look a lot like Alabama and Mississippi, while our expectations for government services look a whole lot like Minnesota and New Hampshire and Vermont. You know, is it possible that Oregon voters have figured out that that's not tenable, that we need more revenue? I mean, they knocked down two tax cuts in measures 41 and 48. And passed lots of local tax measures for local schools, for libraries, for
police.
You know, to me,
Portland voters couldn't say no. I mean, there were basically four ultimately measures that would raise local property taxes, and all four passed.
Pretty extraordinary stuff, and that hasn't always been the case, by the way, in Portland.
Even in March, back when Mayor Potter was taking the case to the public about what to do with the school funding shortfall, you know, the pollsters at the time said, oh, no, voters are in no mood for a tax increase and so forth. You know, we mustn't ask them for anything. And I just wonder whether that was ultimately true, given the results, you know, 6 months later.
It looks pretty clear that it wasn't true, that the pollsters may have been wrong on that. And I think what's most impressive to me is the way that Governor Kulongoski has clearly identified. You know, and there was this big interview with him in the Oregonian on Sunday, in which he clearly identified, you know, the parts of his very strong reelection message that were supported by voters that he was going to carry forward as a mandate. We have unified government now, where the House and Senate and the governor's office are all held by Democrats for the first time, I guess it's since the late 80s. And, well, you know, here we are. They're going to have to deliver now.
They better deliver.
That's the critical thing now.
And I think we have a caller who'd like to see what they have to say. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a question. I read recently that to increase tax revenue or just revenue for the state, because of I don't know if it was Measure 5 or Measure 26, back in the 90s, that the legislature will need 36 votes in the House. Do you know about that? And I'm just wondering how, you know, given that the Democrats only have 31, how much horse trading they'll have to do with the Republicans, and if the Republicans can pretty much just, you know, be obstructionists. And I'll take your answer off the air.
Great. Thanks so much for your call. You know, this has actually been a question that has been going through many circles over the last week, because as listeners may or may not know, any tax or revenue bill needs to start in the House of Representatives, which has been part of the thwarting over the last few sessions. So the question now is the 3/5 vote for any tax increase. And my question is, and I don't know the answer, and I'm hoping that Kari will, or Martin Taylor actually is about to join us. He may also know this question about the 3/5 vote. I believe that it was part of Measure 5 and it was in the Constitution and they actually did define something. But I saw a little thread on Blue Oregon this morning, very briefly, Kari, so maybe you can give us a better answer than the one I'm lamely giving. Kari Chisholm, Chief Cook and Bottle Washer over at BlueOregon.org.
You know, at BlueOregon.com we've had lots of discussion about this, and I actually haven't quite gotten the exact numbers, whether it's Measure 5 or Measure 25, whether it's constitutional, statutory. It does appear clear that it looks like it's a 3/5 vote, which would be 36 votes in the House, to pass new revenue bills. What's unclear is whether or not they can repeal some of these loopholes, these corporate tax exemptions, that kind of thing. That, you know, I don't think there are very many folks, even 31, that are going to support massive new tax increases. I think that's pretty clear. What we might be seeing, though, is an increase in the corporate minimum. Right now it's $10.
Right.
That might get 36 votes, certainly.
There seems to be broad bipartisan support.
And then the question is about a lot of these loopholes and tax giveaways that perhaps were reasonable 25 years ago when they were passed, but no longer make any sense now, just serve as a corporate subsidy to folks.
Well, or for that matter, the corporate kicker, I think, that is potentially vulnerable. It seemed to me that that's where the fight is going to be. It's not just getting the majority necessarily. And I want to back up, too, and say why this may be important for working people. I really feel like the conversation has shifted, and conservatives have really institutionally kind of, you know, put a bulwark, kind of frozen their agenda in so many ways by getting these kinds of supermajority requirements. I think it's really about whether government is going to have the resources voices to do anything good in society. And of course, I think from people on the progressive side of the political spectrum, really, including unions, they want regulation of corporations. They want the environment to be protected. They, above all, want their kids to be decently educated. Maybe they might like to have their seniors have something, some services for them to make sure that they're, you know, looked after. You know, health care for the poor, or, you know,
for
anybody.
Or
for anybody. for example, for Oregon's children, like, you know, the governor, and there's some momentum getting behind this idea of a universal health care for children. I mean, we have universal health care nationally for older folks over 65, so then you just get to the middle and we're there, right? But, you know, one way or another. But I think really getting back to that question of, you know, can government be a force for good in society, or are we just going to, you know, shrink it until it could be drowned in the bathtub, as Grover Norquist famously said? I think that's the issue, and then it comes down to who's going to be taxed how much. And I think that a progressive point of view is probably going to say that, yeah, those who have a lot in this state, be it rich individuals or corporations, ought to be paying more. I mean, we've seen, as you guys both know, for 20, 30 years now, a really steady reduction, both nationally and in the state, in the amount of taxes that corporations pay. So I personally do think that there would be support for that. The voters haven't had a chance to vote on that specific issue, and I think that's what might end up happening if the Republicans dig in their heels in the next couple of years, or I should say in the next year, in the legislature, when they meet. It seems to me that they could get a majority to refer to the voters what they couldn't get a supermajority to pass.
Mm-hmm. Good point. And so on that, as you were thinking about Healthcare for All of Oregon's Children, the Oregon Nurses Association have been working on healthcare issues, both legislatively and ballot measures, and have a proposal to cover all children in the upcoming legislative session. And I would like to invite Martin Taylor, who's the Legislative and Government Affairs Director for the Oregon Nurses Association, to join us. Hey, Martin, how are you?
Can you hear me?
We can hear you. How are things going?
Very exciting time. Trying to contain the euphoria.
Yes. Well, Kari and I have been talking about how we can't wipe the grins off our face. And so I'm wondering, are you smiling as well? That's our Irish eyes smiling. That's my favorite song today. So we've been talking a little bit, Martin, I don't know how long you were on hold there, about the elections, what they mean for working people, and what do you see coming up in the upcoming session as it might relate to issues that working folks care about?
Well, I think it's very clear that you have strong leaders in both the House and the Senate who are committed to doing some substantial health care reform efforts, and those are obviously broader issues than just working people, but I think we're all of us in a system that demands very high costs from employer-based health care, and we end up, those of us that work in unions that bargain contracts, having to make decisions all the time about whether we want better wages, or whether we want the employer to continue to cover a fair share of the healthcare burden. A lot of those conversations will translate in this legislative session to places where both working people and purchasers, businesses, come to the table with a common agenda of reducing healthcare costs. And the question is, can we take advantage of the opportunity that's out there? And there's some other non-healthcare related stuff I'm excited about as well, but maybe we'll have a healthcare conversation first and then touch back on that.
Well, you know, for me, it is all healthcare all the time, but I don't want to bore people with that. So give us some other thoughts. What do you think the impact of the elections are going to be? Is this going to be a brighter day? Are we going to have to fight like the Dickens still? I guess I think a lot about the fact that the best part about the election and maybe having more worker-friendly folks in the Oregon legislature is the fact that we actually won't have to play defense as much as we have been. There won't be a tax on the minimum wage. There won't be, you know, the Tipcratic debacle of the last session where labor actually ended up prevailing, but so much energy and time went into beating back that bad idea, that I'm excited about the opportunity to really maybe move forward, whether it's on health care or other things.
Well, I'm certainly not going to, you know, play the killjoy in this moment, but I do think that Democrats have to understand that unlike 1994, when Republicans came into a big power shift, a big year for them, took control of Congress and a lot of state legislatures off of a contract with America, which was a legislative agenda that they could reasonably say America affirmed. We really took power in 2006 off of a bunch of voter discontent with this Republican administration, Republican Congress, the war, the Foley scandal. We all know that list, but it had a lot less to do with voters saying, we want Democrats who are going to go do those things. I think you're right that the immediate effect in, like, our arena, the state legislature, is there'll be a lot less defense to play. But it doesn't give us the best position to go in and say, hey, the voters just told us they want these four or five agenda items. We will be forced to negotiate more with the minority party. We do run a risk of overreaching. I think there are some things that are cautionary notes that we can't get too caught up in. And what I'm advising Democrats to think about in the state are two things. First, we need to build a mandate over the next 2 years so that in the next election cycle it's very clear what Democrats stand for, that we have our ideas in place, and that in the success we have 2 years from now, we can claim a mandate. And second, that the communication, the thing that Democrats do best is they fight with each other and they spend a lot of time being wonks. We can't repeat that experience. We need to spend our time having a unified message and going directly to the people and trying to bring them into this conversation so that we're not always wonky. We're actually doing a really good job of engaging the public. And, you know, healthcare is a great example of that. If we're doing those things, then we don't have to worry about defense. We have the luxury of doing those things. I think we can really turn this opportunity of 2006 into a place where we build in the long term and not just have a window of opportunity.
You know, I might actually argue with you about the mandate piece, but I know Kari is
I want to argue
here,
as well.
And Don wants
least,
to argue.
Please make a point about
we,
that.
But. We love to argue, Don and I. So go ahead, Kari.
Oh, like a Democrat's all arguing. Hi, Martin. Kari Chisholm here. Mm-hmm. You know, it seems to me that at the national level, we're largely talking about candidates. It's always hard to determine what part of a candidate's profile or their opponent's profile was responsible. You know, of course, here in Oregon, we have these ballot measures that allow voters to tell us a little bit about what they think about the issues. And before you came on, you know, we were talking about how it is intriguing that as much as the national results are a rejection of George Bush and the Republican Congress, what we had in Oregon was also a rejection of conservative ideology. They turned down measures 41 and 48, which were the big tax cuts, defunding, I shouldn't say tax cuts, but defunding of social programs and state budgets. And they turned down measure 45. The term limits measure, rejecting that part of conservative ideology. It seemed, you know, meanwhile, voters passed a lot of local, spending measures, tax revenue, you know, school bonds, police bonds, parks, library levies. And so it seems to me that, at least in Oregon anyway, the voters were pretty clear that they are beginning to understand, their expectations for, services are high. And that their previously stated desires to have taxes be the lowest in the country may not be valid anymore. What's your reaction to that sort of sense of mandate coming from the ballot measure side of things?
Well, I mean, clearly the climate is better for Democrats than it's been for a long time. I wouldn't argue with that, and I definitely think that it's not wrong to say that not only did the voters reject a lot of Republican elected officials, they rejected a lot of conservative ideas in the ballot. But we didn't have a lot of ballot measures that reflected ambition from a Democratic vision standpoint, so we didn't see a lot of things affirmed. The one thing was Measure 44, which was fabulous, but didn't really have any ardent opposition. So I'm not sure that you can read into the length or the breadth of the rejection of a conservative agenda that the inverse is true, that they were just waiting for a bunch of really big liberal ideas on the table.
There was also, to be fair, also
a good job of putting liberal ideas on the table across the board. So I'm not sure we know what voters think about those big ideas.
There was also, I think, to be fair, you know, Measure 47, which was a repudiation of sort of the campaign finance, status quo. I wanted to jump in too about the question of the mandate, because I really don't think that Newt Gingrich's contract on America, as some called it, a contract with America, I didn't really interpret it as a genuine mandate. I think most people really didn't hear about that until after the election. I saw it as more of a brilliant PR ploy in which he actually articulated a specific, well-worked-out agenda, and that sort of excited and galvanized his base. Of course, they didn't actually end up accomplishing a lot of it, but right. Still, it sticks in our memory. I actually think that, you know, the Democrats do have something comparable now. It's maybe not quite as ambitious agenda at the national or local levels, but they do actually have it. There's like a 6-point plan, maybe Kari was familiar with, for Oregon that the House has, and also, you know, certainly the House Democrats in the U.S. Congress also have Nancy Pelosi and has had a set of ideas. And I think, to be fair, the media wasn't really reporting those kinds of substantive things beforehand, and now that they've won, all of a sudden, well, they're interested in, gosh, well, what do you guys want to do? Turns out a lot of these things were already proposed and more or less agreed on, particularly for things like the minimum wage was pretty much a no-brainer if you if you saw Democrats come to power, that long overdue increase on the federal level was going to happen.
So, and just in case, 7 states passed ballot measures increasing the minimum wage.
So I just want to put it out there to all of I know there's a lot of Democratic legislators probably listening to tonight's broadcast. I mean, I do think it can get out there, get in front, at least and say, well, this is what we stand for, and we think that by repudiating the other guys that maybe the voters are supporting of this. Whether it's a mandate or not, you know, fine. You know, you have the votes. Use them.
All right, well, and I'm not arguing with that either. Gosh, those, I've waited a long time to see an environment where Democrats in the state could articulate a clear vision and move an agenda, and I would hate to have them, you know, hear too much caution. Like I said, I don't want to be a killjoy. I just think that there's also the risk of overreaching.
I think it's crystal clear.
I'm more interested in the long term than in the immediate results.
Yeah.
I think that the fact that the media didn't report as much of the Democratic agenda as we may have wished for in the last election cycle was simply because it was less newsworthy than the abominable job that was being done, particularly nationally, by Republicans. But I think it also puts us in a tricky position where we can say, we think we know what we stand for, and we think we know our 6-point plan, but do the voters really know what that plan is? And if they don't, were they voting for it, or were they really just voting against the other guys? If the latter is true, we need to spend some time advancing that agenda before we assume that everyone's with us.
I would certainly say that for those who are looking to or wondering what the Oregon House Democrats, the newly victorious Oregon House Democrats, are planning to do, you don't need to go any further than roadmapfororegon.com, which was the website that they put up in the middle of the summer that has a full agenda for what they're planning to do. I think, Martin, though, you are correct that the danger of overreaching is large. And I also think that the danger of expectations. You know, there's a lot of folks who are listening to this show who are hoping for, you know, the rainbows to come out and money to fall from the sky as soon as the Democrats take control. The reality is that here in Oregon, the Karen Minnis and her right-wing cronies had 16 years of control of the Oregon House to screw things up, and we're not going to fix it in the first 6 months. And I think the thing to do is to make sure we hit the really obvious stuff, the stuff that's gone really haywire, particularly dealing with ethics concerns, you know, gifts, paid for travel to Maui by legislators, things like corporate campaign contributions. Those kinds of things I think are things that need to sort of be dealt with first, and then we're going to move toward a more progressive agenda. And it's going to take, you know, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10 years. We really should think of this as a decade-long project to turn Oregon back around.
Yeah, Martin, again, Don McIntosh here. You know, Kari brought up Karen Minnis and the trips to Hawaii and so forth. This is the fair and obvious question. Oregon Nurses Association supported Karen Minnis to the tune of how much?
$26,000.
I guess the obvious question is why, and any regrets?
No, none at all. I think when you're an organization that is able to move very worker-friendly, patient-friendly legislation in a bipartisan environment, you have some responsibility to support the people that made that possible. And Karen Minnis was the chief sponsor of a bill that allows nurses to negotiate staffing levels, set limits on mandatory overtime, frankly, legislation that is more progressive than any other state in the country has. Now, if we're going to ask her for her help and she gives it to us, she has every reason to expect that we reciprocate. And if we don't, we lose all credibility to ask for help in the future. So that's a place where, you know, personal politics and interest group politics may collide, but if I'm going to do my job right for nurses, I've got to maintain the integrity of our association, and we'd have lost it if we hadn't supported her.
Was that controversial within the ONA?
Of course.
You know, Martin and Mary Beth, obviously you guys are the health policy folks, but I mean, I remember also as a reporter coming in and seeing, you know, a relatively decent set of modest reforms, that, had some trouble getting through the Senate, but were actually, you know, all but killed in the House. And as I recall, basically because of Minnis' leadership, including the, prescription drug, reform, which you then had to go, Mary Beth, and get on the ballot. And apparently the voters liked it. They passed it.
Well, hey, the good news is that you won't have to worry about those kinds of questions in the next legislative session. I would suggest that in addition to healthcare stuff, that a very interesting approach for labor to take next session is to talk about some of the work that SEIU has been doing around fair union elections and organizing. I feel like as someone in the union movement, our path to power is more than anything else getting more people to join unions at a time where membership is declining, and that's becoming much more difficult with the Bush administration and the NLRB. Mm-hmm. Creating an environment where you can't have fair union elections anymore. The answer in Oregon is, I think, exactly what SEIU is doing, which is to create a great deal of community understanding about what a fair union election looks like, and then force through community pressure hospitals or other employers to follow those fair standards. And that's something that the legislature can work on and have an immediate impact on our ability to grow labor in the state.
You know, just this last, about a week and a half ago, Andy Stern, the international president of the SEIU, was on the Nick Fish show on the WB here in Portland.
And on Labor Radio.
He was on Labor Radio as well. I saw him on the Nick Fish show at 6 a.m. on Sunday mornings. And
only because you were up all night from Saturday.
That's
huh?
true. That's true. Still hungover. And you know, he was arguing that, you know, the reality is that if folks are trying to unionize a Providence hospital here in the Portland area, then it ought to be if workers are trying to organize, workers ought to be allowed to vote on whether they want to be organized in a union, and that the hospital itself shouldn't be sort of taking a position on that one way or the other. They ought to stay neutral. And that to me was a fascinating conversation about exactly what you're talking about, Martin, this notion that we ought to support workers when they want to organize and become part of a union.
You know, if we're to look at the election results in terms of, like, from the prism of working people and unionism, I mean, those actually, that Martin, issue that you identified is probably the most important, both statewide and nationally. You know, nationally, there's this bill in Congress called the Employee Free Choice Act, and basically it would require employers to recognize a union if a majority of their employees sign cards basically saying they want to be represented by a union. Now, they actually have, I think probably with the new group going in there, a fairly decent chance of getting that passed in the House. Now, in the Senate, because of its necessity to have 60 people to overcome a filibuster, it's really difficult. And, of course, we know that in the next 2 years, even if both the Senate and House pass it, Bush isn't going to sign the thing. But I think that there's a unique moment possibly for labor that doesn't come along very often, certainly recently. Mm-hmm. And it's also happening, of course, in Oregon, where you have, you know, both chambers of the legislature and the governor, I would think would have a very difficult time turning down a request like that to say, for example, that we're going to say once and for all, state statute, that you're not going to spend resources, public dollars, fighting union campaigns in the public sector, for example, or that we're going to allow card checks. This is something that Governor Kulongoski, did by executive order. But had we had a different result last Tuesday, you know, Governor Saxon would almost certainly have returned that executive order and would have had, you know, public entities fighting their employees if they wanted to unionize.
Right. I mean, those issues you've touched on run a gambit of things that you can only do in Oregon in the public sector, because in the private sector you'd be running counter to the NLRB, and things that if you're creative enough you might be able to influence, like we can't change through a fair elections law, we can't put that in statute and apply it to private employers, but you can say that no public monies, including like Medicare and Medicaid, anybody that receives public monies can't spend any public monies on anti-union campaigns. That gets at many businesses that contract with the state or hospitals, for example. So I definitely think those are the kinds of ideas we need to bring to the legislature, and the fact that we've not really had some of those ideas vetted properly because we haven't had a legislature that, you know, realistically might have passed them means that we might be a couple steps behind, but we have some great examples in California and around us of places that have done a lot of this stuff. And it's time for Oregon to do the same.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to KBOO in Portland, and we're having a discussion about the election results last Tuesday. What does it mean for working people? Our guests this evening are Martin Taylor, the Legislative and Government Affairs Director for the Oregon Nurses Association, and in studio we have Kari Chisholm, Internet Strategist and Chief Cook and Bottle Washer at BlueOregon.com, and Don McIntosh is co-host here with me, Maribeth Healy. So where are we? Are we going to, like, be sitting here in 6 months? Oh, there's my bet. Do we get out of session before or by July 4th?
Yes.
I think they will. I mean, that's part of the one of the advantages of having unified government is that things move a little faster. I think we are going to be sitting here 6 months from now, or I guess 8 months from now, thankful that we had a democratic legislature and a democratic governor. They're going to have achieved some things. I think it's really important, and I'm going to keep saying this, that we not get our expectations too high. We're not going to suddenly have, you know, health care for all Oregonians and full-day kindergarten and, you know, another month on the school year and all the extracurriculars paid for and. You know, we're not going to see.
Okay, wait, Kari, I'm sorry. I actually have a plan. That, like, we're going to achieve major health care reform in 2007. Are you bursting my bubble?
I think Mary Beth for governor sounds pretty good to me.
Yeah, but Kari is right that you can't have realistically an expectation of doing everything at once and maintaining your control of state government. But I think you can realistically take an issue that's popular with the voters and show them that Democrats are capable of doing meaningful reform when they have the reins. And health care is an obvious place to start. I actually think that one or two big ideas need to happen, and if one or two big ideas don't happen, then there's no real reason to have Democrats in control. So they need a one or but you're right, Kari, that if you try to do 18 big ideas, that's where you run into problems. And that is exactly the expectation that I think some people are going to have on these House Democrats. You know, they've sort of taken the mantle of we're the real reformers, and we can do all of the things that have been pent-up frustrations, and that I think the Senate kind of learned that that's a hard thing to do by grinding out two very long sessions. I think the bubble is going to be in the House, and we're going to have some great talented folks there. I think we just all need to be a little bit generous with giving them some room to plot an agenda that sequentially gets us there over 6 or 8 years rather than trying to expect it all in two.
I wouldn't be true to my nature if I didn't jump in with a little bit of a contrarian view. But first, I do want to remind listeners, if you want to join our conversation with a question or a comment for our guests, the number again to call, 503-231-8187. You know, I hear what you guys are saying. I mean, I think there's probably going to be a tendency in the next 9 months to beat up on the Democrats. Certainly in the last session in 2005, I think a lot of people were really disappointed in the Democrats in the Senate. They really didn't get much of anything done, I think it's fair to say, and this being the first time that they'd had that chamber for a while. So I think that's going to be a tendency anytime you've been out of power for a while and you're in power. But I also want to caution against going too far the opposite way. I think there should be accountability, and I think that people should expect something. In fact, I think if the Democrats know anything, if they're going to survive, they're going to have to show results because this is the time. I think that one of the reasons that people have not been excited about the Democratic Party, one of the reasons that folks like Tim Nesbitt are going out and forming new parties like the Working Families Party is that a lot of people, particularly working people, really do have felt shut out by the Democrats on a whole lot of issues, and they feel like, you know, if the question is, well, what do Democrats stand for? And if no one knows, then, you know, well, I guess you know what the Republican stands for. And if you care about guns and God and gays and these kinds of things, well, you know, in the past, you tended to vote Republican. I think the Democrats are going to have to really define themselves, and not just for political reasons, but because that's what politics is about, ultimately. It's not about who is in office or what letters after their name. It's about doing something for people. At least I hope.
For voters.
Yeah.
I think it sounds like we're all pretty much in agreement. It's just a matter of tone and
so are we all going to be fighting down there? Because, you know, you'll want education, I'll want health care, you know, Don will want...
I want public access to information about corporations. Like, I really, really liked that bill about how much corporations pay in taxes, and it was so sad to see the Oregon Education Association, you know, basically sort of barter that away in return for the business group's commitment to fight those very, very bad measures. I'm not second-guessing them, but as a reporter, I was awfully sad that we weren't going to have access to the information like, you know, how much does Nike pay to the Oregon State Treasury every year?
Well, and to be honest with you, Don, I don't think that all issues have equal amount of political risk. Like the disclosure measures, there's very little political risk in that, and Democrats can and should do that. They can and should reform the initiative process so that we don't have to spend millions of dollars, you know, defeating slates of bad measures again and again. They should do, you know, a bajillion of the little things that all improve state government that have been undermined. It's really the question of, you know, the 18 big things all sound like huge environmental bills, civil unions, you know, six tax votes, you know, health care for all. It's that big stuff. And you know, that's where I think, I don't even think we're disagreeing necessarily. I just think you sequence that out so that you give the voters something positive and visionary and exciting, but you do it one at a time so that you keep them with you and you don't scare them off by trying to do everything at once, particularly things that have a huge tax impact.
I have to say one thing. This is going to be a good session. It's going to be short, and Democrats are going to look great, in part because the economy's bounced back, and there's a lot of money right now. And that sounds like a strange thing to say, but Barbara Roberts inherited a huge budget problem. Kulongoski inherited a huge budget problem. This time, the Democrats took control at the right time. We can make a lot of people happy with the budget situation. The only chance I think we have of spoiling moving from 31 to 33 or 34 in the next election cycle is to come across as guys who finally got the keys to the kingdom and went crazy.
I think the House leadership is ready to roll. I don't know if you guys have a better impression of the Senate.
I think it's pretty clear there's a whole lot of low-hanging fruit out there.
Yeah.
Don, you said earlier that the Senate didn't accomplish much, and I'm remembering back now, they kept talking about the undone dozen, the 12 bills that the Senate passed that got stuck in the House, didn't even get a hearing in Karen Minnis's House, much less a vote. And I think a lot of those bills are the ones that are going to get done this time. You just kick them out of the House. There was very little change in the House. If I remember right, two or three members changed, but the partisan orientation didn't. And so we're going to hopefully those bills come kicking right back out of the Senate, and this time they'll sail on through Jeff Merkley's House and land on the governor. I'm going to stand up and cheer every time we see the gavel drop on the Senate side with a majority vote, and the gavel drops on the House side with a majority vote, and a bill goes sailing upstairs to the governor's office, and he whips out that pen and signs it. And it can happen very fast, particularly on these bills where there have been hearings, and the work has been done, and the research has been done. It's just a matter of getting it through Karen Minnis's House. And now that she's going to be sitting in a back bench somewhere with an office in a windowless basement somewhere, God bless her.
Five of those bills were mine, Kari. I have to share. Or healthcare related. I am really optimistic, Martin, about our opportunities for healthcare reform. And I agree with the three of you with the overreaching. But I will also say that I think when 877, give or take whether there was opposition to ballot measure 44 or not, when 877,000 Oregonians say reduce the cost of health care because that's what they did by voting yes on that measure, then I think that is a mandate for the legislature to take that issue, which had an incredible impact in many of these legislative districts. It was the number one or the number two issue. It wasn't Iraq. It wasn't the scandals in Washington, D.C. It was how am I going to afford health care for my family, and when are we going to hold the fat cats accountable in the health care industry to loosen up some of the dough and provide health care for all Oregonians?
Well, I think that the polling that you reference is really telling that health care is no longer a partisan or a liberal conservative issue. Everyone is getting eaten alive by the high cost of health care. It's a business issue. I got a small business owner that's got to pay out of their pocket for health care issue. I mean, it's so pervasive across any demographic now that I think it is a time where you can do that, and the political risks are a lot lower and the expectations are a lot higher. So, sounds like cherry picking. I work for the nurses, but I think if you're going to sequence things, that's a pretty obvious place to start.
It seems to me, if we're living in a world in which, health care inflation is healthcare inflation is so big. The prices are skyrocketing so fast that if overall inflation is only growing at 3% or whatever, state budgets are growing at 2 or 3%, but healthcare costs are growing at 16, 17, 18, 20%, ultimately those are trains that have to crash. Those are lines that do have to collide. That ultimately if you don't do anything about that, clearly, the math alone will tell you that healthcare costs will eventually eat every dollar of the state revenue. And long before we get to that, we're going to have a big old train wreck. And so it's better to deal with it now. And, I'm not a healthcare policy wonk like the two of you, but it seems to me that, John Kitzhaber, our former governor, is certainly on the right track when he says, at least in terms of the big picture, we're spending all we need to spend on healthcare. We need to arrange it so that the money is being spent in better ways. Perhaps there needs to be some additional money, but basically, basically, we need to arrange it in better ways so that more of the money goes to deliver health to people and not simply spent on insurance, which is a funding mechanism.
I think also the governor, or former Governor Kitzhaber, is right about the idea that the states can really serve as an incubator for the reform that the nation is going to have to take. And of course, this would be a chance for Oregon to really reclaim its mantle as kind of that the kind of the forward-looking progressive state that, you know, with reforms that no one else has heard of. And we've kind of fallen down in recent years on that reputation. I think this would be a chance to follow some of his ideas and get back that. You know, I think statewide and nationally, what I've been looking for a long time is for the 5/6 of the economy that's not in healthcare to finally get sick of paying for the healthcare costs of their employees, which they can't control, which is out of control, and sort of turn on that 1/6 that's the medical industrial complex, which is basically, you know, pharma and the hospitals and so forth that have been able to prevent any cost control, that have been able to prevent any provision of universal healthcare or anything resembling a sensible system that everyone else in the world has at this point. So I think that moment is probably coming soon. I don't know. I mean, I remember like last year costing out, if you looked at the continued double-digit annual increases in the health premiums, you know, we were looking at like last year was $900-something dollars a month for full family health care coverage, and in 10 years' time, that would be $2,500. Well, there's no employer in America that's going to want to pay, an equal amount for, health care coverage for their employees that they're paying in wages. And I think at some point, we're probably getting pretty close to that train wreck you're talking about.
Well, and I think, too, we have, with some of these new folks that are coming into the legislature, we have Tina Kotek coming in from North Portland, who is a fabulous healthcare advocate, very smart around the issues. To think that we would have a Carolyn Tomei or a Mitch Greenlick, who's got 25 years of healthcare policy behind him as chair of the healthcare committee, as opposed to Billy Dalto, I got smacked down election day, that we have some real opportunities. Dave Edwards, freshman coming in from Hillsborough, he will be our surprise healthcare advocate. He spends 26% of payroll providing healthcare for his employees. That is the train wreck, and it is coming, and I say it's January 2007 that we can start putting the brakes on that train.
And Meredith's right that you not only have democratic control, but you actually have something as valuable or more valuable, which is policymakers who are really experts on healthcare issues. And, you know, adding Sarah Gelser from Corvallis and Gene Cowan off of the coast to that mix, you've got, you know, at least five or six folks in the House whose expertise surpasses what they had to work with last session. But there's another really important piece to the conversation, Beth, about healthcare and all the rest of this, and that is the Blue Oregons and the Oregon Bus Projects and the KPOJs and KBOOs and the Our Oregons. That what has really emerged in a very short time in Oregon, in probably 4 years, is a piece of communication and organizing infrastructure that has absolutely turned things around in the state. And I think part of keeping Oregon Blue Oregon is recognizing that this isn't a bunch of voters that said to Democrats, go into the legislature and do this stuff for us. This has got to be a state that's all about using those communication networks to get this stuff done. Community organizing and messaging, making sure that when we start talking about health care and Lars Larson's on the other radio station talking about how this is a big tax increase in socialized medicine, that stuff goes contested. It goes contested within organizations through Our Oregon. It goes contested through the bus project and hitting on people's doors. It gets contested on blogs. For the first time, we can fight that fight and win, and that's why we're winning. That is every bit as important to this conversation as putting expectations on lawmakers.
I want to return to Tim Nesbitt's metaphor, which I mentioned earlier, of the sea change and what's happening in Oregon and becoming bluer, which I do think has been happening for a while now, and it's becoming more and more apparent. You know, I think part of it may be, in the bigger picture, a kind of an unfortunate consequence of the polarization that the country is undergoing. I mean, to some extent, I mean, you know, recent results notwithstanding, I mean, I think that there is, geographically, there is a polarization. It's still underway. And I think people are choosing to live in places that sort of reflect their orientation and their their lifestyle and so forth. And really, obviously, the coasts very much now becoming the blue, you know, the sort of more progressive strongholds. You know, what I think is going to be the key to any kind of national solution may be something along the lines of what SEIU is endeavoring to do now, the idea of actually organizing the South, unionizing the South. You know, it's not enough on the national level to just sort of, you know, hang in there with where you've got supporters. You've got to get out there and actually take a progressive message to the heartland of America. And I think, you know, personally, I guess I'm pretty excited to see, you know, we have Gene Mechanic is a local well-known labor attorney who's going off now at the end of this year to work doing strategy for SEIU in Florida, you know, helping to organize the South. I mean, if that really gets started, I think it could have far-reaching political consequences. And I think it's an example, you know, big picture again, of where the labor movement needs to get back into mass movement mode.
Well, you know, Don, you're heading into my other project. You know, a lot of folks know me here from blueoregon.com, but, you know, at westerndemocrat.com, we've been tracing the rise of the Democrats in the inland Rocky Mountain West, at what some people call the Purple Mountain Majesty strategy. You know, it was just a few years ago, we had 8 Republican governors in 8 Rocky Mountain states. There are now only 3 Republican governors in those 8 Rocky Mountain states. We have Democratic governors in Montana and Wyoming and Arizona and New Mexico, and now in Colorado. I'm starting to sound like Howard Dean naming states. But you know, the Rocky Mountains are the place where Democrats are ascendant. And, you know, we're going to see, they've now moved the Nevada caucuses into the presidential calendar. We're going to go from Iowa to Nevada, then New Hampshire. We're also going to see probably, not done deal yet, but probably the 2008 presidential convention for the Democrats will be in Denver, the first time ever in the Mountain Time Zone. You know, something's going on in the West. And, you know, if we want to talk really big picture, in 2008, we're going to win the presidency because we're going to win one, two, three, or four of those 8 Rocky Mountain states that George Bush swept in 2000 and 2004.
You're listening to KBOO Radio at 90.7 FM on your dial. We have a few more minutes left if you'd like to join in our conversation at 503-231-8187. We have Kari Chisholm here from BlueOregon.com and Martin Taylor with the Oregon Nurses Association. My name is Maribeth Healy.
And you're with the Oregonians for Health Security. Check that out online at Oregonians for Health Security.org. And I'm Don McTosh again with Northwest Labor Press newspaper, nwlaborpress.org. Check that out. It's actually quite a decent archive of union news, which you really can't get anywhere else. This program being sort of the radio equivalent of that. We really can't get a program about you know, perspectives of working people and those kinds of issues. You know, we're sort of moving in the last few minutes of this show to the national. I mean, we've got the state to the Rocky Mountains. What about the national scene maybe has excited you guys in terms of what matters for working people?
Well, I think if indeed the House Democrats stay true to their 100-hour plan, I am the most excited. I'm excited about the minimum wage. I am excited about that. I am the most excited about sticking it to the drug companies. And they will now have to sit down and negotiate with the largest purchaser of prescription drugs in the world and give our elders and people with disabilities and Americans a decent price on their pharmaceuticals, because that has been the biggest outrage. And I guess that's where I also think that it was a proactive agenda that got Democrats motivated. It wasn't just we hate the Republicans. And I think that is really the big difference, because you can say we hate the Republicans all the time. That's how we've been losing elections in the past. But there was actually a plan to move forward. Did it encompass everything? No, it was 4 things, right? Implement the 9/11 commission, increase the minimum wage, negotiate with the drug companies under Medicare Part D, and there was one other that...
Ethics reform.
Thank you. Ethics... Oh, how could I forget?
And
ethics reform. So I do think there was a proactive agenda, but it is the negotiating with the drug companies that I will take personal pleasure in.
I think what's interesting is the way that other than Iraq, the way the national agenda mirrors the state agenda here in Oregon. In Oregon, we're pretty good on the minimum wage, sort of stop that stuff. But when we talk about ethics reform and campaign finance issues, as well as the healthcare stuff and the prescription drug stuff, the two seem to dovetail very nicely together. And I think Oregon voters are going to be very excited to see their Democratic Congress doing it at the national level while their Oregon Democratic legislature is doing it at the state level. We're going to be a little more successful here at the state level because we have ourselves a Democratic governor. And I think the Democratic Congress is going to make the case for why we need a Democratic president in 2008. Can you imagine if we went from 2002 to 2008, having shifted both the legislature as well as Congress and the White House and kept the governorship, shifted it all from red to blue?
It'd be a different state and a different country, and I think that's actually how people that I know that are in tune with me politically really feel right now. It's like this great big weight has been lifted off their shoulders, and an end in sight. George Bush, as we know, is term limited to 2 terms unless they change the Constitution.
Ain't gonna happen now.
So I do see an end in sight for the bad era and potentially a new republic or something like that. I wanted to say too. I don't say this very often. I like to say I told you so, and I don't like to say maybe I was wrong. But in this case, on this program, and quite a few times, I kind of bashed David Wu a little bit for that vote that he had on the Medicare Prescription Drug Act. I mean, basically, for those listeners who remember, this last year we kicked off a program that's the biggest boondoggle in recent memory, where basically the U.S. government is going to pour hundreds of millions, of dollars into buying drugs for old folks, which is a good thing, but they're not going to try and get a good deal for it because they refuse to negotiate with the drug companies for the price. I actually remember talking with a very shrewd analyst in D.C. who was working for the Consumers Union. Actually, he was working for Families USA as a consumer group, very good check them out. He said that the drug companies did...
FamiliesUSA.org.
Thank you. And the Consumers Union, of course, publisher of Consumer Reports. He said at the time that the drug companies were a little squirrely on this, that they didn't necessarily... This wasn't necessarily their act. This was the Ideologues Act. And the drug companies were a little bit worried about the Medicare Modernization Act of 2003 because they were worried that if a Democratic Congress took over, that the government would all of a sudden use its bargaining power to bargain down the price that they charge for seniors. And I think, the president's not going to say anything in the next 2 years, but they might just get a bill that does exactly that.
Well, I think that's all they really need to do. I mean, I don't want reimportation from Canada. That is not a policy solution. We don't need to reimport the drugs. We need to reimport the policy because they negotiate with the drug companies to get the best price. And I think that's a place to go, and it's what ballot measure 44 does here in this state. And as we kind of wrap up here, as we're approaching the 7 o'clock hour, Martin, is there anything that you want to add?
Just a very quick thing, which is that easily overlooked on the important list of things that Democrats need to do in Congress would be to address Kentucky River, because mm-hmm. Kentucky River is perceived as a kind of nurse issue. Kentucky River is a set of cases that redefined a supervisor from a previous definition that said that you had hiring and firing and a couple of other important responsibilities to simply saying a supervisor is someone who delegates work to others. There's a complex legal explanation that I can't give this quickly, but the important thing is that they applied it to charge nurses. They will eventually apply this to as many as a quarter of people who work in this country who will neither be in management positions nor in positions that now are permissive for collective bargaining. They'll be in this new category of supervisor without management authority.
If we don't get that changed,
we're looking at losing not just our charge nurses, but a tremendous number of working people in this country that is really designed at putting the dagger in the heart of labor and our ability to have political strength in this country. And that's one of the really important things we've got to get turned around.
Excellent point, Martin, and a great way to end the show. We'll do something on Kentucky River in the future. Thanks so much for joining us on KBOO Portland. You've been listening to Labor Radio, a show about working people and our excitement about potentially moving forward for working folks in the elections and in the 2007 legislative session. Thanks so much.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from SEIU Local 503 OPEU, whose mission is to improve the quality of life through worker empowerment and a progressive labor movement, and whose members deliver quality public services to Oregonians every day. And also by Ironworkers, Shopmen's Local 516, and the Pacific Northwest Ironworkers District Council, proudly fighting to preserve living wage jobs and resisting their outsourcing. Information at 503-257-4743.